Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Man who has served his country with great distinction in a variety of different capacities on several of its different battlefronts in this war for the free world is our first guest. He is Congressman Scott Perry. He represents the people of the 4th District of my home state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. He serves on several critically important committees, including the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Homeland Security Committee, and the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. And in fact, in each of those, in areas that touch on directly issues of the vulnerability of this country to terrorism and specifically its infrastructure and the need for preparedness of that infrastructure. He served in the United States Army as a combat helicopter pilot, flying all kinds of aircraft on some 44 combat missions in Iraq. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's great to be here. Appreciate the opportunity.
I'm really pleased to have a chance to showcase a couple of things that you've been involved in lately, which are near and dear to my heart and I think that of my audience. Start with, if you would, the hearing you had, I believe, last month now in connection with the impact that the president's decision to close Guantanamo Bay would have on state and local communities in this country, should it involve the movement here against the law, needless to say, but nonetheless, the movement here of detainees from there.
Right. That's exactly right. Had a hearing just last month on the closure of Guantanamo, or the proposed closure and the moving of those detainees to the continental United States and a couple states in particular, Kansas and Fort Leavenworth and Governor Haley's state, South Carolina. And the ramifications of that, and quite honestly, we found a couple things. First of all, that there are huge ramifications to moving those prisoners, those detainees.
The worst of the worst, as they've been called.
Of the worst. There are no good. There's no upside to this that we can tell. And the other thing is, and if you watch the hearing, it's a little bit long, but especially if you get to the end, my questioning of a particular individual brought to the panel, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress named Ken Good. And when I looked into his background, now, Frank, this gentleman has a degree in history, and that's his entire qualification for having been the individual who wrote the executive order to close Guantanamo, and continues to be cited as an expert in that arena. And in my questioning, it was determined that, number one, he has zero qualifications other than, I can't remember, but I'm going to paraphrase, he watches TV and he's interested in the issue and is making statements on it and has an opinion on it. Those are his qualifications. He has no military background. He has no national security background. He has no diplomatic background, but yet he's advising the president on issues of national security and strategic national policy. And I think that should be concerning to every American.
It sounds like the perfect guy if you're indifferent to all of those considerations.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, this, Frank, you know the history well, where the media goes out and looks for an expert and gets the story they get that the administration wants. This has all been concocted, and this has been done in the past. If you go back to the tidings panel with McCarthy and the communist version of America, they did the exact same thing. But the facts are they have no data whatsoever to support their claim that these prisoners, these detainees, should be moved to America, that will make America safer, that will be less of a magnet for terrorists, less of a magnet for recruitment. They have no data whatsoever to support their claim. It's simply a claim that they're moving forward with.
And there will be, in your judgment, Congressman Scott Perry, an increased threat to public safety arising from this, right?
There absolutely will be. I mean, if Guantanamo Bay is hard to get into for terrorists, but if you move them right into South Carolina or right into Fort Leavenworth or into your community somewhere in some maximum or minimum security prison, that's now going to be the focus of jihadists around the world. Why in the world would we do that? And, of course, the president has already this year in 2016 released more of these detainees than he did in all of last year. So he's just moving full steam ahead, moving them to places like Oman and Yemen and Kazakhstan and, you know, places that have dubious repute regarding their allegiance and fealty toward America.
Let me switch to one other real serious problem that I know you're focusing on as well. We talked with your colleague, Congressman Lou Barletta, last week about a hearing in a subcommittee on which you serve in the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee on the prospects of the electric grid being taken down through cyber means or something else. Give us a flavor of how serious a problem you consider this to be, Scott.
Well, it is a serious problem on a number of fronts, and I think the hearing, generally speaking, at least from those who came in, the discussion wanted to center around, or they thought it was going to center around cyber, which, look, that's a big part of it, because the grid and protection of the grid on a cyber front is critically important, and it's probably the Achilles heel of the grid. But I had some other questions for these folks, and maybe Americans don't know, but 499 units, nearly 82,000 megawatts of capacity have been shuttered due to EPA regulations. And I asked these folks, how do they account for that? I mean, you know, how do you replace that? And what's the remedy when they determine too much capacity has been removed, when we can't keep up, when it's one of those really hot summer days and everybody wants to run the air conditioner, or, you know, they're going to be brownouts and, you know, so that was kind of where I was headed with the whole thing. And of course, that's all in the context of this thing called the Clean Power Plan, which has been stayed, thank goodness, by the courts, essentially cap and trade, which would shutter even more.
Scott, so again, looking at this particularly, as I know Congressman Barletta was doing, from the perspective of states and local communities that are going to have to contend with this, what did the hearing indicate was the likelihood that this is going to be catastrophic?
Well, of course, nobody can predict exactly how much or when this could occur. The fact is that it could occur, whether it was through a cyber attack, whether it's through EMP, whether that's naturally occurring, or whether it's by an enemy, a state or state non-state actors. We don't know, but we must be prepared. Number one, and certainly being prepared doesn't include closing power plants just for the sake of the EPA without any plan to make up the difference in that portion of the grid. And what's apparent to me is that they haven't considered that, and they have no plan, and they don't have any data to support any of those decisions.
Hey, listen, before we run out of time, Scott, let me ask you about one other thing. And again, our guest is Congressman Scott Perry, the 4th District of Pennsylvania. You mentioned this history major who wrote the Gitmo executive order. We've had a fiction writer, a man who at least graduated with that as his degree, namely Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor to the President, acknowledging very publicly in the Sunday New York Times magazine last weekend that he had lied to the Congress about Iran and, I guess, about other things as well. How's this sitting with people like you, and should he be forced to resign, as your colleague Senator Mark Kirk has called for?
Well, you know, for lying on public policy, I almost think that would be considered a fraud, and maybe not only should he resign, but maybe he should be prosecuted in that regard. But this is, as you know, Frank, this is very, very concerning. This is in regard to the Iran nuclear deal, which many of us were very concerned about, and you know, we talked to our constituents and the American people about how bad this deal was, and when we find out that it was sold all based on lies. Of course, we knew that at the time. I mean, you and I talked about that this deal had started back with Ahmadinejad, that the president had been negotiating with the terrorist regime over the very same thing. And then we find out that not only did Ben Rhodes do this, that the administration has essentially erased a period of about 8 minutes of tapes with James Rosen, where he questioned them on their lies about it and how they were using the lies to sell it to the American people. So, you know, and then if you put that with the sale of or the purchase of heavy water, excess heavy water from Iran, giving them not only legitimacy of that program, but hard Western currency in the way of American tax dollars. I mean, this deal just keeps on getting worse and worse, and where literally the American tax dollar, based on a lie, is being used to promote an armed nuclear Iran.
Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon, and your service to our country in uniform and out is really appreciated. Dan Cadman joins us next. We'll talk about Obama's wrecking operation on immigration. Straight ahead.
Visit us at Facebook.com/SecureFreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
we're back. We're joined by Dan Cadman, who is now a senior fellow at an absolutely indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. He has been, for decades now, some three of them, in fact, working in the space of immigration policy and practice as a member of the Immigration and Naturalization Services and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Organization, including as a senior supervisor and manager at their headquarters and in field offices, both domestically and abroad. Dan Cadman, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm interested in sort of at the outset getting an overview from your perspective as a seasoned professional in this business as to what the Obama legacy is likely to be with respect to immigration policy and practice, as well as the enforcement of the laws.
Well, it's like taking a finely tuned Swiss watch, peeling off the back and dismantling all of the cogs and wheels, and then exclaiming in dismay that everything is in disrepair and that the clock no longer works. It's a willful dismantling of the government's ability to enforce any portion of the immigration laws. It's astoundingly broad in scope, and I have to believe done with deliberation.
Systematic is the term that comes to my mind, and I think I call it a wrecking operation. It's true in other parts of the government. I guess you might also call it a fundamental transformation of America, as the president promised before his election. We're talking with Dan Cadman, a professional in the immigration space, about what the Obama administration has been doing to his profession and to the public safety and public interest as well. And Dan, you've written about a sort of collusion between an international body, the United Nations, specifically the UN Commissioner, High Commissioner on Refugee Affairs, and some of our federal agencies, the State Department, the Health and Human Services Department, specifically, I guess, with respect to undoing our immigration policies. Give us some examples of how this is working in practice.
Well, for instance, after the surge of unaccompanied minors and families on the southern border, which really embarrassed the administration, rather than shut down the border and promptly deport people, which would have been the most effective way of inhibiting further movement north, they simply shifted their focus south of the border and opened up a program called Central American Minors. And what they are doing is routinely processing individuals down there. And when they say minors, translate that loosely. That's people up to 20 years old. And even when those people don't meet the definition of refugee, and it's a very expansive definition that they're using, they're finding ways to parole them into the United States under the Immigration Parole Authority, which is an abuse. And they're bringing them in at government expense by the thousands. That's merely one example. Another example is the way, working with UNHCR, that the State Department has collaborated with HHS, as you said, and even with the Department of Homeland Security, to collapse this so-called exhaustive interview process for Syrians down to 3 months in order to make sure that they can shove as many Syrians into the country through the rest of this fiscal year as possible, to make sure that they have topped up their quotas, so to speak. And now UNHCR is calling for, quote, alternative pathways. And interpret that to mean they still want the U.S. and anyone else who's willing to do this to bring in as many people as possible. And if they don't qualify as refugees, to find different ways to bring them in, whether it's as students, as visitors, as so-called skilled or unskilled workers. What they're trying to do is empty the refugee camps, and there's a great deal of peril attached to that kind of enterprise.
Well, especially since, as we've heard from the top law enforcement officers, notably the FBI director, there's no way properly to vet these people to assure that we're not simply importing more jihadists. Let me ask you about that. We'll be talking more about it with Dinah West shortly, but there's something that you've called attention to, which is very worrying to, I think, the layperson, let alone people who have been working in these vineyards as you have, Dan Catman, namely this idea that there is a right to migrate. What's up with that? And where is that right formalized in any way?
Is it formalized in any international or even domestic statute? No. It's been adopted widely and in practice, however, by things such as the administration's abuse of prosecutorial discretion, which is to say abuse of discretion, by creation of any number of programs for which there is no statute to back it up, and which, functionally speaking, have opened the doors. And one of the evidences of this is that even though the administration is doing this Central American Miners Program, our southern border is still being surged by tens of thousands of individuals from Central America every month. And the Border Patrol estimates that this year will exceed all prior years by the time they're finished.
You mentioned in one of your recent pieces, Dan Catman, that the administration has shown itself to be very capable of using the sort of coercive power of the state to bend states and localities, notably, to its will. There are plenty of examples of this. But they have not used this power at all with respect to things like sanctuary cities. Very quickly, what is the practical effect of giving a pass to cities across the country who have categorized themselves as such? And what does it mean in practice?
In practice, what it means is that if the federal government isn't going to insist that state and local government law enforcement agencies comply with immigration detainers, then when alien felons are released from state prisons or even county jails, they're released back into the street, back into the community. And statistically, it's been shown that a shocking number of these individuals go on to commit further crimes, and a lot of them have been very, very violent crimes, including murder, assault on minors, sexual assault on minors. Some people have been maimed. It has resulted in literally hundreds of murders, assaults, thefts. And some number of these people are also border drug mules. And of course, what are they going to do when they're released? They're going to go right back to smuggling drugs.
This is of concern to me in the broader construct of this idea that we're going to have criminal justice reform. And it turns out among the people that will be sprung, apparently, are not just mules, but some kingpins in the drug trafficking business on the grounds that they're nonviolent drug offenders. Looking at it, again, from your perspective, Dan Catman, is that advisable?
Completely inadvisable. We have a perilous, porous border. And releasing people not only who were the foot soldiers, but the fellows in the middle and upper echelons is a virtual guarantee that the kind of violence and drug and weapons trafficking that we see on the border will continue unabated.
On the border and across it, inside the interior of the United States, increasingly, as you know so well. Dan Catman, I am very grateful to you for taking some time with us today, as well as for your service both in the INS and ICE departments and of course, now with the Center for Immigration Studies. I hope you'll return soon. Thank you very much for your work, sir. Next up, we'll be talking with Diana West about this immigration business, Donald Trump, what's happening in the United Kingdom, and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney.
My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. National security fraud has been a hallmark of the Obama administration. Fraudulent claims to have reset relations with Russia, disarmed Iran, and routed al-Qaeda are just a few of the more egregious examples. Now, Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes has actually bragged about deceiving the public and Congress about the president's fatally flawed deal with Tehran. The mullahs are $150 billion richer and more able to pursue their nuclear ambitions, aspirations for regional hegemony and jihadism, thanks to Rhodes' successful bait and switch. Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois is among those who thinks that Rhodes' public admission of his lying to lawmakers should require his resignation. Anything less will only affirm that perpetrating national security fraud is standard operating procedure for Team Obama. Worse yet, it will assure there is more of it to come. Ben Rhodes must go. This is Frank Gaffney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realized their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined as we have the privilege of being about this time each week by Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist who is now blogging up a storm at dianawest.net. Diana is also the author of two extraordinarily important books, both, I think, bestsellers at this point, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Diana West, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
I wanted to get your take on the election last week of a Muslim as the mayor of London. This is noteworthy not so much because he's a Muslim, though Britain, of course, is not a Muslim nation, but that he is an Islamist, as best I can tell, one with considerable ties to and sympathy for the Muslim Brotherhood and its ilk. What does this tell us about what's happening in the city of London, most especially, and perhaps in the United Kingdom more generally, Diana?
It tells us a lot. It tells us a lot that we, in many ways, already knew. I would say going back nearly 15 years now, when I first started looking at all of these changes coming over the world through the demographic shift from the Islamic world to the Western world, I remember being told that Great Britain was going to go first in terms of being Islamized. And I think we've seen that. We've discussed over time the normalization and incorporation of Sharia law into British law, the Sharia courts, certainly the cities, the strife, the violence, and the spread of Sharia culture. We look at London, which is over one-third foreign-born. A quarter of that born outside Europe, I think some very high percentage of that would be Muslim. And now we see a Muslim mayor with, as you note, with ties to all kinds of very extreme, radical, jihadist types, unapologetically so, and indeed coming up through the sort of human rights wing of that vector of Islamization. So this really shouldn't be shocking. It certainly isn't anything new. It's the latest capstone to this sea change in Europe that does reflect a lot of policies that go back to certainly Tony Blair, who is one of the villains of this piece in terms of allowing, permitting, encouraging this massive demographic tidal wave that has just overwhelmed the nation for 20 years at least.
Let's talk a bit about the plight of our friend and much admired colleague Vladimir Bukovsky at the hands of his own government. Diana, what's going on?
Well, this is what I've been very much involved in studying of late and thinking through, and very distressed because there's so little press and public discussion of this, and I thank you for bringing it up. Vladimir Bukovsky, I would say without any question, is the most courageous man alive in the world today. He certainly is the longest and greatest enemy of the old Kremlin still extant. And at the moment, he is...
The old Kremlin and the current Kremlin,
the
let us
Kremlin.
Say,
yes.
Since there's a lot to be comparing them
yes.
to, right?
Absolutely. A very, very open enemy of Vladimir Putin's regime as well. And he is right now fighting the British legal system in the battle of his life, literally. He is into about the 20th day of a hunger strike over his frustrations, over an impasse with the British legal system. I've written about this at my website. It's a bit complicated. I recommend people go there, dianawest.net, and also seek out the fine work of Claire Berlinski. I think the two of us are the only two American journalists to be touching this story, which is shocking. There is currently a legal ban on British press to even discuss a very unusual libel suit that Bukovsky has brought against the prosecutors that have charged him with very lurid crime, possession of 5 or 6 images of child pornography. He strenuously denies this and will be pleading not guilty to these charges, but meanwhile, what he's watching is his entire reputation destroyed, and this is the fight he is fighting, because what he has and his legacy of fighting totalitarianism, of courage in the face of state power, is this beautiful, courageous, stainless reputation that the British system, I do believe, having studied it, has gone after in a most feckless, criminally, possibly, or irresponsibly manner, probably on purpose. And to put this in perspective, this is the same British government that has permitted literally generations of young British girls to be sexually despoiled by Islamic rape gangs, as the grooming gangs. We have been watching how the British state has turned a blind eye to actual destruction of British girlhood for literally several generations at this point. So we have to say, is turning the avenging sword of the state onto Vladimir Bukovsky all of a sudden out of nowhere last fall and determining that there's evidence, we don't know where this evidence comes from, we suspect it comes from Russia, that there is some kind of forbidden imagery on his laptop in order to protect children, the welfare of children in Britain, it doesn't ring true.
But more to the point, describe why the Russians might have wanted, aside from their long-standing enmity, particularly of Putin, to this courageous dissident from the old Soviet era and a man who has gotten into the archives and exposed a lot of the terrible things that the Soviet Union did and now is keeping book on Putin in connection particularly with an assassination of a man on British soil. Give us the story there.
Yes, Alexander Litvinenko was assassinated by the Russian government in 2006 using a radioactive poison, polonium. This was only recently, it took so many years for the British inquiry to take place, which is another can of worms. It finally took place just just last year. And Vladimir Bukovsky was one of the prominent voices to come and testify. The testimony is online with the Litvinenko inquiry, very easy to access. This would have been in March of 2015. These charges against him were brought by the British Crown Prosecution Service in April of 2015 in the most, well, it's a unique way. I studied it very carefully. There are 100 charges available for people to peruse on this prosecution website, on their news press release site. Only one of them is framed in the way of Vladimir Bukovsky's in terms of prosecution for these charges.
Diane, I do want to pivot lastly, though, to one other question that you've been addressing, and that is this whole issue of what the Islamists are trying to do through this migration, not just to Britain and not just to many other countries in Europe and elsewhere in the free world, but here as well, with the connivance of Barack Obama. And specifically, Donald Trump has achieved, to my way of thinking, the unique status of having really injected this full force into the national political debate by saying, wait a minute, we don't need to import any more jihadis. This is an issue on which he is apparently at odds with Paul Ryan very quickly. Could you just tell us what you think might come of their conversation tomorrow?
Well, I hope not much, in the sense of I don't want to see Donald Trump conceding to Paul Ryan any of his program. Paul Ryan masquerades with this notion of principle being at stake, but really it's ideology. Paul Ryan is a mass immigration, very soft on Islamic immigration, actually enabled massive amounts of refugee resettlement and so on. So they're at odds politically. This is not a matter of principle. And since Paul Ryan, actually in the recent Wisconsin primary, his district, even though Donald Trump lost the state, his district was won by Donald Trump. And I think that that is very, very significant in terms of the kind of position Paul Ryan really has, certainly also as speaker and as proposed convention head.
Diana, we have to leave it at that. He has a challenger running against him in that district, of course, Paul Neelan. It'll be very interesting to see how this plays out there as well. Diana, thank you as always for the great work you do, notably on the Bukovsky case, but on so much else. Please check her out at dianawest.net. We'll talk with you again next week. Up next, Michael Smith joins us. We'll talk with him about emails and cybersecurity and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today,
all right, let's go,
or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has in 2015 begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Every year, more American adults die from vaccine-preventable diseases than from breast cancer, traffic accidents, or AIDS. Vaccines like the one for pneumococcal disease can protect adults from illnesses that can cause missed days of work, hospitalization, and even death. Pneumococcal disease is an infection that can lead to pneumonia, meningitis, or even a severe blood infection. That's just one example of an infection that can spread from person to person. Getting vaccinated can help protect you and those close to you. I'm Dr. Susan Rehm of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. When I speak with my patients, I urge them to get all their recommended vaccines. Now I'm urging you to speak with your doctor to find out which vaccines you need. For more information about the vaccines that are recommended for adults and the diseases they prevent, like HPV, whooping cough, tetanus, and shingles, visit adultvaccination.org. That's www.adultvaccination.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined once again by Michael Smith. He is these days the principal and COO of Cronus Advisory, LLC. But he has been contributing mightily, both in the media and behind the scenes, to the understanding in Congress and elsewhere about the nature of the threats we're facing these days, particularly in the information technology space. He is always welcome here. Michael, thanks for coming back. Good to talk with you.
Hi, Frank. It's good to be with you and your listeners.
You've been doing a lot of work, Mike, in the field of information technology as it relates to the use being made of it by the Islamic State and I think other sort of Islamic supremacists. But specifically, the extraordinary degree to which Twitter is now enabling the propagandizing and other communications of some of the world's most dangerous jihadists. Talk a bit about what Twitter is doing and whether they know that they're doing what they're doing with respect to these guys.
Sure. To put a little context on it, online, the Islamic State is managing the most aggressive and, as far as the casework here in the United States demonstrates, effective recruitment, coup, incitement program of any terrorist group in history. It is engaging in a much more interactive recruitment program than Al-Qaeda has ever dreamed of doing through the internet. And Twitter has become the crucial tool in all of that. Twitter has basically in the past 2 years become a cyber sanctuary for the Islamic State, from which it is not only calling for people to immigrate to the so-called caliphate to help the group defend and expand its territorial holdings. But if they cannot do that, which increasingly they cannot due to the barriers that are being put up to prevent that from happening, the other directive being issued by al-Baghdadi and his followers and the propagandists, and for which Twitter has become a veritable echo chamber, is to wage jihad at home. And Twitter has become the centerpiece in all of that activity. And what has become absolutely striking is that whereas Twitter was providing varying degrees of access, unique access to all of that content for the intelligence community, which amounts to just a vast amount of data that's used to develop a richer understanding of the Islamic State, its members, its potential growth, where it is going about orienting the focus of its recruitment activities, particularly here in the West. Twitter has cut all of that off all of a sudden in recent weeks. And I had a meeting with a sales rep to the federal government from Dataminer last week. And Dataminer is a company that basically the intelligence community via CIA's venture capital arm, InQtel, made a significant investment in to develop capabilities to analyze and sift through what's called the fire hose, which is all of the content on Twitter, for which Dataminer has exclusive access to all of it. Other companies can go and buy pieces of that content, buy packages of data that have been produced with certain terms that are used to come up with that information, but Dataminer has access to all of it. They have gone to Dataminer and they've gone to all the other companies that are just purchasing slices of the fire hose data sets and sharing that information with the intelligence community and said, you can no longer do that. We do not want to be involved in assisting the intelligence community with counterterrorism activity. And just basic intelligence work. And it is absolutely perhaps the most striking example of corporate irresponsibility that I can think of this century.
Amazing. Let me just make sure I understand this and that our listeners do, Mike. And again, our guest is Michael Smith of Cronus Advisory. You're saying that Twitter is not only a cyber sanctuary for the Islamic State to operate in, and again, other jihadis as well, but most especially, most aggressively, the most dangerous of these outfits at the moment, and that to the extent that they're using Twitter's facilities, platform, if you will, that the Twitter folks are now telling an entity that they own part of that they may not help data mine that information for the purposes of trying to prevent attacks by the Islamic State in places like the United States. Have I got that right?
You've got that right. And as explained to me by, you know, the representative Dataminer, who deals directly with the federal government in, you know, selling access to the service that they offer. And this is according to him, of course, that Twitter views greater growth opportunities overseas than here within the United States. And it is concerned about the optics that come into play with having a relationship of any kind with the United States government, particularly the United States intelligence community. It is concerned that that will negatively impact interest among potential advertisers overseas or just users in general would have concerns about, you know, their content being utilized to support intelligence activities in the West.
Mike, you were quoted in a Newsweek article, I believe, last week, in which they were talking about, among other things, that the Islamic State is now putting out hit lists, I guess, through Twitter and other social networking platforms, Give us a flavor of how serious a threat this represents when combined with what are, I think, wrongly described as lone wolves, or individual jihadists, if you will, who are perhaps prepared to act on these instructions.
To, again, provide some context, in September 2014, the Islamic State spokesman, who also doubles as the external operations portfolio manager, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, released a statement in which he called upon individuals in America and Europe and elsewhere to go out and kill military officials, intelligence officials, police officers, and just random Americans. So what you started to see was in 2015 under Junaid Hussein's leadership, and eventually with assistance from Ardit Farizi, who has been charged with facilitating a massive hit list for the Islamic State, you started to see content flowing out on Twitter. And eventually, as Telegram Messenger created its channels feature, and you saw a lot of these Islamic State members and propagandists migrate to utilizing those channel features, you saw a lot of those hit lists or links to them starting to show up on those channels. On Twitter, back to that, they have put out the home address for America's top intelligence official, DNI Clapper. They have put out the home address with a photograph of his home for CIA Director Brennan. They have put out home addresses posted in individual tweets repeatedly for a variety of senior, current and former officials from military, intelligence, law enforcement, and diplomatic communities. And we've even seen Hillary Clinton's address show up in Telegram Messenger. When our friend Mike Flynn, former DIA director's address showed up on Twitter, I got in touch with Mike immediately last year and asked, hey, are you still living at this address? And he said, no, thank God, I moved several months ago. But the fact is that they have good information. They're putting it out there, and they're issuing directives now for people to go out and target civilians. They have obviously, as has been variously reported, put out a hit list containing the names and addresses and various contact details, such as email accounts and phone numbers, for more than 3,500 people who reside in New York and Brooklyn. And I saw that list, I captured that list, and I was contacted by somebody at one of the top three largest newspapers in the United States several days thereafter, who comes to me for background on Islamic State-related issues and asked, you know, have you seen this list? Because one of my colleagues at the newspaper was contacted by the FBI, and she was concerned about how real this is. And I said, well, you know, what is your colleague's name? And I pulled up the list, and sure enough, the colleague's name was on the list. So this has become a very sizable problem. This can kind of accelerate the will to act when you're doing something sort of abstract, like saying, oh, go out and kill people. That's one thing. But when you're actually providing a target list, that provides an incentive that creates a different paradigm.
And when some of those targets may be close at hand and you don't have to schlep to Syria or run the risk of being arrested and trying to do so, you can do a little jihad right here. Keep up the good work at Kronos Advisory, Mike, and come back to us again if you would soon. I hope the rest of you will come back again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.